Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, First Lady Barbara Bush. We know her as the wife of one president, the mother of another. She became an unwavering advocate for literacy and for many years the grand dame of the Republican Party. With her pearls and gray hair, she was dubbed everyone's grandmother and often kept silent on political issues, deferring publicly to her husband, George H.W. Bush. In a new book, Susan Page of USA Today peels back this public persona to reveal a complicated woman and argues that Bush's influence on the country was greater than anyone gave her credit for. I talked with Susan about her book, The Matriarch, at a live event at Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. Well, we are here to talk about this. What I have to say is a fabulous biography of Barbara Bush. And there may be, Susan, a number of people who are thinking, why Barbara Bush and why now?
So in covering campaigns in White Houses, I've covered the last 10 presidential elections. It's really my only job skill. Thank God they keep holding elections so I can be employed. When I would go out and talk to voters, they all thought they knew Barbara Bush, and mostly they liked her a lot, and they thought she was warm and grandmotherly and authentic, and she was those things, but she was so much more than warm and grandmotherly. She was tough, smart, shrewd. She could be mean. She was influential in the administrations for both her husband and her son. She is, in fact, the only person in American history who's had that experience of being the wife of one president and the mother of a president, and to be alive at the time her son was in the White House. Abigail Adams' son was also elected president, but she had passed away before he took office. And she was no shrinking violet when it came to either administration. And there are issues in which she played a really crucial role that have been discounted. I really think she has been underestimated throughout her life by her mother and her teachers and her husband and herself. She was a complicated woman, and she suffered more pain and grief in her life than was ever revealed. So that is why I thought it would be worthwhile to examine the life of Barbara Bush.
Susan, I think that many people saw her as tough. Certainly the press regarded her in that way. But inside, this woman, from your research, was about as fragile and as unbelieving in herself as just about any other woman I've read about. Tell me where that came from.
So Barbara Pierce Bush had a father she adored and who adored her, but she had a really fraught relationship with her mother, and her mother cared a lot about appearances. She had what her children called enthusiasms. And her greatest enthusiasm was for Barbara's older sister, Martha. Martha was slender and beautiful. She was so pretty that she worked for a time as a model. She was on the cover of Vogue for the college edition of Vogue when she was in college. And she had another brother, Jimmy, who was always in trouble but charming. And she had a younger brother, Scott, who was very ill as a child. And so I asked her, tell me about, if you had to characterize you and your siblings when you were growing up, what would you say? And she said, Martha was the pretty one. Jimmy was the Peck's bad boy. Scott was the perfect one. And I said, well, what were you? And she said, I was the little fat one. And that was a view of herself that she had through her whole life. She was very insecure about her looks. And, you know, she would joke. She would always make a joke about her weight. and her white hair. And I think that, and that was disarming to people, but I think that there was a germ of truth when she made those jokes. And I think she did it to prevent anyone else from talking about her weight before she had made fun of herself.
When you told her or asked her what she thought the book should be titled, what did she say?
So Barbara Bush didn't like anything about the title that I had chosen. She didn't like the word matriarch. She didn't like the word dynasty. And so I said to her, well, what would you call this book? And she said, The Fat Lady Sings Again.
So, but she finally accepted the matriarch.
Well, it was my book, so she wasn't going to, like, tell me what to call it.
But, you know, this is the most intimate portrait of Barbara Bush that anybody could ever imagine. She gave you how many hours, how many sessions, and then, most striking of all, access to the diaries that she had kept for how many years?
She started keeping her diaries in 1948, and she made the last entry in her diary 12 days before she died. But, you know, I signed a contract to write this book, not having contacted her or any of the Bushes beforehand. And this was possibly idiotic, but but here was my reasoning, that if I wanted to do the book, I knew I wanted to do the book. If I contacted her and she said, I will not cooperate, I would have been greatly discouraged. I don't know if I would have had the confidence to go ahead and try to do it. But if I called her and she said, yes, I'll cooperate, and you said that before I had actually signed a contract and was on my way, maybe she would think she had some sway over what I wrote. And I didn't want to do an authorized biography. I wanted to do a piece of journalism, an independent work. So I signed a contract with a publisher, and then I wrote her a letter and said, I will do this book. I'd interviewed her over the years. I said, I am going to do this book, and I hope you'll let me talk to you. And she said that I could come down and interview her in Houston. And we had no greater plan than that. So I did the first interview. And, of course, I didn't at that point know if there would be a second interview. And so this was the fastest talking, most ground covered interview you've ever heard, because I thought it was possibly the only time I would talk to her. She was 92 years old. She must have been exhausted at the end of it. But at the end of it, I said, can I come down and interview you again a second time? And she said, yes. And after the second interview, I said, can I come interview you a third time? And she said, yes. And that went on through five interviews. And we had, in fact, a sixth interview scheduled. I had gone to Texas for the sixth interview. But the night before we were going to get together again, she fell. She broke her back. She went into the hospital. And she never recovered again. Now, in the very first interview I did with her, she said, do not even bother to ask to see my diaries. You'll never be able to see them. And that was disappointing, but it wasn't surprising, because if you'd kept a diary, would you like let a reporter see them? Possibly not.
Did you know about the diaries?
I knew about the diaries.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
In the third interview, I asked her, you know I can't see your diaries, but could I see the diaries that relate to your relationship with Reza Gorbachev? Because that was something that was really interesting to me and ended up being a chapter in the book. And she said, I'll think about it, which I thought meant no. And in the end of the fifth interview, which turned out to be our last interview, although I didn't know it at the time, I stood up to leave, and she said, I've decided you can see my diaries, all of them.
Wow.
And I had the worst possible reaction, because I was so stunned. I said, are you sure? But the gift of seeing her contemporaneous thoughts, her observations, the way she vented in her diary in ways that she couldn't do in public, it was an extraordinary gift. And I've wondered why she turned around on that issue, because I hadn't really lobbied her on it, because I thought it was a closed case. And I think that her health was getting worse and worse, as at each interview. She was in worse. She was in great mental shape, but she was in worse physical shape every time I saw her. And I think she probably knew that she wasn't going to live for another interview. I think she probably knew that that was the last time we were going to see each other. And if she had not given me permission to see her diaries, no one would have been allowed to see them for 35 years.
Wow.
Under the provisions of the gift that she made of the diaries to the Bush Library. So this was extraordinary.
And I think you said earlier her relationship with her mother was so formative, but perhaps the most affecting time of her life, and which dwelt with her for the rest of her life, was the death of her child. Talk about that and read for us from that chapter.
So Robin was 3 years old when she was diagnosed with leukemia, a disease that neither George nor Barbara Bush had ever heard of before. Robin's illness and her death 6 brutal months later would forever change Barbara Bush. The experience would steal her resolve and broaden her understanding of the ways the innocent can be caught and crushed by the unfairness of life. It would leave an indelible stamp on her about what matters and what doesn't. It would cement a bond between her and her firstborn son that would last until Barbara's passing. And it would test her marriage. George's and Barbara's responses to Robin's illness and eventual death would forge a template that they would follow through the ebbs and flows of their long union. Barbara was a strong one during Robin's painful treatment as George dissolved in tears. With Robin's death, Barbara was the one who collapsed in sorrow, and George became her rock. The pattern of one stepping up when the other was struggling and of being able to switch those roles between them would sustain the couple during times of political defeat and personal pain. It would prove to be crucial decades later when Barbara Bush struggled with depression and again when the elder George Bush was embittered by his defeat for re-election to the White House. But nothing would ever match the heartbreaking struggle that robbed them of any sense of the seasons in 1953. The morning after Robin died, on October 11th, 1953, Barbara was shocked when she suddenly noticed that the leaves on the trees in her hometown of Rye in suburban New York were at the peak of their fall colors. The last time she had paid any attention to such things was 6 months earlier in Midland on that March day. Quote, "I remember realizing life went on," she said, "whether we were looking or not."
That last sentence, was that from her diary? Or did she say that to you?
She said that to me.
Interesting. That death, in part, led her to have a far greater sympathy and understanding for those with HIV/AIDS and with other diseases that perhaps she would never have thought about previously.
And you know, Diane, it took me a while to realize what a stamp this experience had left on her. And when I was writing, you write a book proposal for publishers. And when I was writing the book proposal, I said the first chapter of the book would be the 1988 campaign, the campaign that put George Bush in the White House, and that the chapter on Robin would come back where it fell chronologically. And when I wrote the first draft of the book, that's exactly what I had done. And it just was wrong. It just felt all wrong. Because the 1968-88 election may have been the defining experience for George H.W. Bush, fulfilling his long ambition to be president. But it was not the defining experience for Barbara Bush. The defining moment for Barbara Bush came with Robin's illness. And decades later, on a variety of issues, it would be the touchstone that she would turn to. When Bush went into the White House, the AIDS crisis was raging, and the Reagan administration had not paid enough attention to it.
Enough.
Yeah.
Any.
And there was, it's hard to remember now the stigma that was attached for people with AIDS. And when Barbara Bush saw that, here's what she saw. She saw the time when Robin was clearly not getting better. They'd taken her to New York to Sloan Kettering for treatment. George Bush's uncle was a doctor there and urged them to come there for cutting-edge treatment, although no one had ever survived leukemia before. There was no case of leukemia being cured at that point. And Robin underwent very difficult and painful treatments. They decided to take her home to Midland for one last visit so that she could see her two brothers and neighbors, and the Bushes could see their friends. And when they did that, some of Barbara Bush's closest friends refused to come and visit because they thought leukemia might be catching. And when Barbara Bush looked at what was happening with AIDS patients, that's the lens through which she saw them. And that's why during the first 100 days of being First Lady, she did something that was extraordinary for the time. She went to Grandma's House, which still exists here in D.C., which was a hospice for babies with AIDS. Many of them had been abandoned by their parents. And she made a point of picking up a baby named Donovan, a six-month-old boy, and hugging him and putting her cheek to his cheek. And she made a point of doing this in front of news cameras because she was sending a message that you couldn't get AIDS by picking up a baby. And she then went into a private meeting with some adults who had AIDS, and this was closed to the press. And one of the men who was in this meeting, Lou Toscani, said to her, you know, people think babies are blameless, but they don't think that of us. We need a hug, too. And in this private meeting, Barbara Bush said, I'll give you a hug. And in fact, they embraced. And then when they went out to where the news cameras were, she made a point of giving him a hug again so that there would be pictures of it that would be transmitted that would say also, adults with AIDS need acceptance, an embrace, a hug, too. And 2 years later, Lou Toscani was dying in the hospital of AIDS, and he was having a very tough time of it. And a friend of his who worked on the Hill called Barbara Bush's office, didn't have a name, cold called the White House, asked to talk to Barbara Bush's office, got Anna Perez on the phone, who was then Barbara Bush's press secretary. And he said, you know, I have a friend, and he was sure he would have a very difficult time getting through. He said, I have a friend who met with Barbara Bush when she visited Grandma's house, and Anna said, oh, Lou Toscani. That's how much this visit had meant to Barbara Bush and the people in her office. And he told her that Lou was dying and in his final days and having a tough time. And Barbara Bush wrote him a handwritten note, a handwritten letter that said, Lou, I'm thinking of you. Your life has meaning. Your life has value. You've made a difference. And his friend told me that this made all the difference for Lou in the final days of his life.
And there was Barbara Bush being strong, being resolute, and yet there was a time in her own life when she became almost suicidal. Why?
It was 1976. The Bushes had just come back from China, where he had been the top U.S. diplomat there. He had taken a job to head the CIA, a job his wife told him don't take because what he really wanted to do was be president, and she thought that was not exactly a natural path to the presidency to head the CIA. But he took the job anyway. And, of course, it's a job that you can't come home and tell your spouse all about what you learned that day. As she said, you know, I couldn't keep a secret. I would keep it for a day, and then I'd tell somebody. So after decades of playing a big part in her husband's life, in his professional life, she wasn't anymore. Because she had an empty nest at home. Her kids were all either away at school or starting life as young adults. She was going through menopause. She thinks that might have had an impact. But at the time, she didn't have this insight into what was going on in her life. She just fell. All she knew was that she had fallen into a terrible darkness. And she told me that she would be driving and have an impulse to plow into a tree or to steer into the path of an oncoming car, and that she would have to pull over to the side of the road and stop and wait for this impulse to pass. So she was suicidal. And no one, the only person she talked to about it was her husband, who was, she says, supportive, encouraged her to get help. She didn't go to get help. She, in retrospect, she thought she should have. But, you know, you see the impact of this experience later when one of her granddaughters struggled with drug addiction and mental illness. And in reading her diaries about her granddaughter, there was never a sense of, why doesn't she straighten out? You know, why doesn't she just have the willpower to do better, to stop taking drugs, to straighten out her life? I think that reflects her own experiences with knowing that mental illness is not something you can kind of wish yourself out of with willpower. But it was so at odds with her public image, you know, that public image of being strong and kind of stoic. Yeah, and exactly. Even when I was working on the book, I talked to her younger brother, Scott, the perfect one, who in fact is an incredibly nice guy. So I can see why he was the perfect one. But he refused to believe that she was seriously suicidal, because that is how much she masked that part, that episode in her life.
She became one of the most popular first ladies, and yet she was not by those arranging all these political campaigns for George H.W. Bush. She was not considered an asset. They sort of pushed her to the side.
The 1980 campaign was the first campaign I covered. And in fact, George H.W. Bush was the first national politician I ever interviewed. So I covered that campaign. And this was still a surprise to me when I researched this book, that the campaign was very nervous about Barbara Bush. They thought she looked too old. They were presenting George H.W. Bush as the young leader of a new generation running against Ronald Reagan, who was much older, a generation older than he was. And they worried that Barbara Bush undercut that image because she had white hair. Her sister-in-law came to her one day and said that the family had had a conversation about what to do about Barr, to get her to dye her hair and to lose some weight and to dress snappier, is the word that Barbara Bush used with me. And this was, as you can imagine, pretty wounding for Barbara Bush, who already had insecurities about how she looked. And in that campaign, I went back to look at the TV ads that they aired in the first part of the primaries. And they didn't feature Barbara Bush. They didn't show Barbara Bush, even though Bob Dole, who was also doing ads at that time, was doing ads that featured Elizabeth Dole as a big asset. And then I looked at some of the campaign flyers that they produced in that campaign, and some of them didn't mention he was married. And in one of them, there was a picture of him, and Barbara Bush is standing behind him looking at him adoringly, but she's not identified. It's not, she could have been a stalker. You know, who knew who she was? So you speak of someone being underestimated. She was underestimated as an asset in that first campaign. But by 1988, when he ran for president again, she was one of the more important political advisors, strategists, at key moments in that campaign. And by 1992, when he ran for re-election, he was practically trying to ride her coattails.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more from Susan Page.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Page of USA Today. Her new book is The Matriarch, Barbara Bush and the Making of an American Dynasty. Let's talk about Bush as vice president and Barbara's relationship with Nancy Reagan.
So, you
pretty
know,
bad.
Everybody knew that they weren't best pals, right?
To put it mildly.
But the depth of the, or the heat of the tension between them was really astounding. And one of my favorite finds in this book is, those of us of a certain age remember the most glittering event of the Reagan White House, which was the White House dinner for Princess Di and Prince Charles. Do you remember that, where John Travolta danced with Princess Di? It was the best ticket you could get in the Reagan White House. And when the Reagan White House had state dinners, the Bushes were always included because protocol required including the vice president. But Prince Charles was not a head of state, so this was not a state dinner. And the guest list went to Nancy Reagan of who to invite to this dinner. It went from the social secretary. And the first name was President and Mrs. Reagan, and the second name was Vice President and Mrs. Bush. And Nancy Reagan took her pen and crossed out the Bush's name.
How do you know that?
Because we found it in the Reagan Library. And there's a picture of it in the book. It may be my favorite picture. And then we found subsequent memos, because they would, like, every day or two, they would have an updated guest list for this big dinner. And the social secretary would say, suggested names to add, Vice President and Mrs. Bush, and their name would be crossed out again. Finally, Mike Deaver, who was the Deputy White House Chief of Staff and the person who was the West Wing person closest to Nancy Reagan, called her and said, you can't not invite the vice president to this dinner. And she said, just watch me.
Whoa.
And they were not invited to the dinner.
There have and had long been rumors about George H.W. Bush's relationship with another woman, which everybody around them, including the two, denied and denied and denied. What did you find out?
So I think it's important to note just what you did, that George Bush denied it, Barbara Bush denied it, called it a smear. Jennifer Fitzgerald, the woman who was involved in the rumors, denied it the few times that she was asked about it. And that's something we shouldn't forget, that they denied it. But there was aspects of George Bush's treatment of Jennifer Fitzgerald that fueled these rumors for a decade. Because Jennifer Fitzgerald was first controversial within the staff. She was difficult for others to get along with. Some staffers left Bush's staff rather than continue to deal with her. James Baker, who was, of course, Bush's great friend and ally and served him through all these years, in that first campaign in 1980, went to Bush and said, Jennifer goes or I go. And Bush said, I'll think about it, and didn't tell Baker until the next morning that Jennifer would be moved out of the campaign. Rumors about the relationship became public, and yet Bush continued to keep her on his staff and close by his side. And there are those who believe that they did have an affair, and there are those who believe they didn't. And it was something that came up repeatedly. I ended up writing a fair amount about it. Here's what I know for sure, that whether these rumors were true or not, they were enormously painful for Barbara Bush, who found herself repeatedly in interviews having to address them and deny them. And so this was among the things that caused her real anguish during campaigns.
One last question, and then we'll invite those of you who'd like to pose your own question to come forward. It was always believed that Barbara Bush was indeed pro-choice, and yet she kept silent for the sake of her husband. Do you think she was disappointed in herself for having done that?
So first, let me, if I may, describe how we know more fully now what her views on abortion were. So I had access to her diaries, and they have not been curated yet. They've no archivist has gone through them. They're just like boxes of papers kept in a locked cage in the Bush Library. And so having gotten permission to see them, and the only other person who had gotten permission to see them was John Meacham, who wrote the wonderful definitive biography of George H.W. Bush, Destiny and Power. He was the only person besides myself who had permission to see them. They'd bring out these boxes and pages would be stuck together and they would be like totally out of order. And it was in a way that made it more difficult, but it made it an incredible journey to go through them. And I'm looking at her diary from 1980. So he's about to make he's making his first campaign for the presidency. And I open up the diary and there are four sheets of paper, yellowing paper, folded in half, tucked in the diary. And I pull them out and open it up. And it says at the top, thoughts about abortion. And they're underlined. And what it was it was a letter that Barbara Bush wrote to herself as she tried to figure out what she thought about abortion. She knew she was going to be asked about it on the campaign trail. And she wanted to figure out what she thought. And on these four pages, there is never a mention of the political calculations surrounding abortion policy. She was looking at it completely as a moral issue. And where she came down was shaped by Robin's death. And here's how she described it in her own handwriting, and hardly any words marked out. I mean, she was writing with some confidence to herself, I think, even as she tried to figure this out. She said, "I remember when Robin was born, and I felt her soul into her body. And I remember when Robin died, and I felt her soul leave her body. And if your soul enters your body at the moment of birth, abortion is not murder. And therefore, it should be left up to mothers and fathers and doctors. And it is not a presidential issue." And she underlined "not" two or three times. So she came to this conclusion that was her view on abortion. On the side of the, up the margin on the fourth page, she wrote, "needs lots more thought." But the fact is, she never changed her mind about what she thought about abortion because she had made a decision based on what she actually felt in her soul. It was a philosophical question, not a political one. But when her husband got on the ticket with Ronald Reagan, one of the conditions was that he was going to support the platform. And what that meant was support the Republican platform view on abortion, which was an anti-abortion rights position. And Barbara Bush then just stopped talking about it. And I understand that you interviewed her and she just refused to tell you what she
Absolutely.
Thought about it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I interviewed her twice. Never said a word.
Because she so adored her husband that she did not want to complicate his life. And her view was, it matters what the candidate thinks. It does not matter what the candidate's wife thinks. And I'm not going to create problems for him. And I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
Wow.
But she began to talk about it more openly
after
once he was out of office.
Yeah. All right. Questions first.
My question is about Barbara Bush's relationship with Bill Clinton. It seems really unique that she came to see this man who defeated her husband as one of her adopted sons.
Yeah.
So could you talk about her relationship with President Clinton?
So, you know, Bill Clinton won over George H.W. Bush after they were both out of the White House. They did that tsunami relief trip. Clinton was very deferential to Bush. Bush really liked that. They pretty quickly, I think, became people who had put aside that very bitter 1992 campaign and were friends. Barbara Bush was a little harder to win over because she was pretty skeptical of Bill Clinton. She complained that he cheated at golf, which was apparently a kind of original sin where she came from. But she came to believe that the friendship between her husband and Bill Clinton was real. And she came to think, as many others did, that Bill Clinton, whose father died before he was born, saw in George H.W. Bush, at least to some degree, the father he had never had. And she respected that. But she, to the last day, had a more dyspeptic view of Bill Clinton than her husband did.
Yeah. Over here.
Most liberals that I know didn't hold George Senior in high regard until Junior came in. Did Barbara express any sense of disappointment in her son's presidency?
So not disappointment in her son or his presidency, but she had a big difference with him on the war in Iraq. And, you know, when George W. Bush was elected, his father made a famous promise that he wasn't going to give advice unless he was asked. And George W. almost never asked his father for advice. His mother had not made that promise. And she felt pretty free to make advice. And the war in Iraq became a real source of contention between them. And she would complain to him that he was listening to the wrong people. He had basically pushed aside Brent Scowcroft, who had been on the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, had previously been her husband's, had been the first Bush's national security advisor. George W. had pushed him off the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Barbara Bush thought he was paying way too much attention to Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld. She told him he was taking the wrong course. And he eventually became annoyed by the fact that she kept raising this issue with him. And he finally said to her, "I'm the president. I'm making the decisions, not Dick Cheney or Don Rumsfeld," and basically told her to back off, which I think she did at least to some degree. But it was, I think, the issue on which they had the biggest difference during her son's presidency.
I'm going to follow up with that and ask you about her time clock for Donald Trump.
So this will surprise you. She did not like Donald Trump. And she made it pretty clear to everybody around her that she didn't like Donald Trump. But in Kennebunkport, a friend of hers gave her one of those countdown clocks, Trump countdown clocks that show the days and hours and minutes and seconds until President Trump's first term is over. And she put this on a little bedside table in their bedroom in Kennebunkport next to a chair where she would sit and she would needlepoint and watch TV. And she liked it so much that when they went back to Houston at the end of the summer, she brought the countdown clock with her. She parked it on the bedside table in Houston, and it was there the day she died.
Wow. Next question.
I spent 27 years in the fire department. I was a firefighter. I retired 3 years ago. I spent most of that time starved for female mentors. Based on your research, based on what you know now, do you consider her a mentor, even posthumously? And what would you say, as you speak mostly specifically to the women in this room or to my 20-year-old daughter, what did you learn from this that you would tell them they should emulate in their own life?
Well, first of all, thank you for your service at the fire department. I have to say that my mentor is sitting right here.
Sweet.
But, you know, Barbara Bush had a very interesting attitude toward feminism. And it was complicated. And I thought of her as a feminist because she was strong-minded. She had her own opinions. She didn't mind expressing them. She, you know, she was no wilting flower. But in one extended conversation we had about this, she refused to say she was a feminist. And I said, "Well, why? What is it about feminism that you don't accept?" And she kind of talked around it, and I finally gave up. I said, "You're really being slippery on this." And she said, "Yes, I am," like quite proudly. You know, I think she felt dissed by feminists. I think that when the women's movement began in the 70s and 80s, I think that she felt the life choices she had made were being devalued. You know, I went back and looked at how she was portrayed. And Saturday Night Live did skits about making fun of Barbara Bush, having Phil Hartman portray her in drag. So it was the most insulting possible depiction of her, right? And goes right to something she worried about herself. And they had one skit where they have a very attractive actress playing Elizabeth Dole, and they're praising Elizabeth Dole. "Oh, you've done this, and you've done that, and you've done this. You're so wonderful. You're Wonder Woman." And then they turn to the Barbara Bush character and they say, "We understand you're making a rug," which she was in fact needlepointing a rug. It took her 8 years to do it.
Wow.
And I said, "Did that hurt your feelings?" And she said, "No, and you're sitting on the rug.
I've seen several interviews with Barbara Bush, and what I gathered most from those were the fact that she was so hysterically funny. And whenever I see her talk, I can't stop laughing. My question is, what, in terms of what you saw, do you think was the secret that let their marriage last so long and become so successful?
You know, I think they were complementary. They weren't the same. They were pretty different. And she could be pretty sharp, but he could be a little soft. I think that's what made their marriage so strong. They fit each other well. There were some critical points politically where she encouraged him to run some tough ads that he was reluctant to run. And he ran them after she said famously, "I think it will be all right, George," after he had refused to be swayed by the political strategist advising him. And those were important in his political success. Whether you think those ads were a good thing to do or not, they contributed to his success. He also softened some of her edges. And maybe you know couples that are like that, where one they each make the other better. There was one point where her father had died, and Scott, the perfect brother, was helping to support their stepmother, who nobody in the family had really gotten along with. And he called his sister Barbara to ask if she would help him send some money to help support this stepmother that neither of them really liked because their father had passed away and he felt it was their responsibility. And she said no and hung up. And Scott told me that a few minutes later the phone rang and it was George saying, "No, Barbara gave you the wrong answer. Yes, we'll send you some money." Wow. So we should all hope for partners like that, right? Yeah. That make us better in the places where we're not as good.
Question here, please.
So my question is about how you balance your role as a journalist and then your role as a human. And when you were going through these diaries and reading these really intimate things, were there just moments of deep emotion, and did you feel, you know, intimate, like in relationship with Barbara Bush? And was there anything that you considered maybe not putting in the book because of that?
Good question.
So, you know, I've been a journalist a long time. I've been a human even longer. But I generally think of, and this may sound terrible, I think of myself as a journalist first. I mean, I think journalism is an obligation to your readers. Your obligation is not to be a human, it's to be a journalist. That said, there were many things in the diaries that I didn't use because the standard I tried to apply was, does this illuminate something about Barbara Bush? There were things in her diaries about other people that would have been very wounding to them that didn't tell us anything about Barbara Bush. So I didn't include those things. But there were things that... you know, Barbara Bush probably wouldn't have wanted me to talk so much about her mother or about how she worried about her self-image. But I viewed that not as a human, but as a journalist.
Susan, one person you haven't talked about is Laura Bush and the relationship between her and Barbara Bush. How would you describe it?
So I think Barbara Bush appreciated the fact that Laura Bush got her son on track. You know, George W. Bush had a time famously when he didn't have a lot of purpose in life. And his marriage to Laura Welch really helped him find his way. And especially when their twin girls were born. And I think Barbara Bush appreciated that. Laura Bush was also, I think, deceptively strong. I mean, I think we think of Laura Bush as being
very
quiet and shy, and that is true, but she is also a very strong woman. And Laura Bush was willing to convey that to her mother-in-law in a way her mother-in-law, I think, came to respect. And all of us with mother-in-laws may recognize this this push and pull.
Yeah.
But I think they came to a very respectful accommodation. And when I asked Barbara Bush who had been the best first lady, she said Laura. Now, maybe that was a family calculation, possibly, but that's what she said.
I wonder, did you ask Laura the same question?
I did not.
You did not. I think we have time for one more question.
What did you learn about Barbara Bush which most impressed you in terms of her character, number one? And then number two, how do you think she viewed her own role in her husband's presidency or professional life? Because she was a mom, you know, and a wife.
I interviewed more than 100 people whose lives had intersected with Barbara Bush, family members, friends and relatives and staffers and people who didn't like her much. And for almost every one of them, I would end the interview and say, now, if George Bush had not married Barbara Pierce, would he have become president? So it's an unknowable question, right? You can't rerun history. But what do you think? And so when I asked Barbara Bush that, she said, absolutely. He would have become president if he hadn't married me. And when I asked George Bush that, he thought about it for a minute and he said, yes, I believe I would have. Which I thought was like, no husband should answer that question that way. If you're ever asked this question, do not answer, yes, I would have done whatever I did without my wife. And I think that is a sign that they both underestimated her, because I think they're both wrong. I think she was indispensable to the success that George Bush had, including becoming president.
And even James Baker agreed with you.
You know, James Baker agreed with me. And when I asked Bill Clinton this question, he said, absolutely, he wouldn't have become president. And he said, the thing you have to admire about George H.W. Bush is that he had the guts to marry her. Because she was tough. She was formidable. She was fierce. But she was vulnerable. And she had an impact in a positive way on AIDS, on cultivating relation with Reza Gorbachev that helped the negotiations that ended the Cold War. I think you had made the point that we all love the Bushes now. Whatever policy differences people have with George and Barbara Bush, whatever you think about, and of course he lost his bid for a second term, I think that just about everybody sees them as honorable and decent and well-meaning and people who had the interest of the country and Americans at heart. And I think a lot of people wish we could get back to that time.
Well, it's a fabulous book. So I want you all, really, it's a great book, Susan. Congratulations, and thank you for sharing your time.
And thank you, Diane.
Oh, I loved it. Thank you all for being here. And that's all for today. I must say, I won't be surprised if Susan Page's book is a prize winner. I'd love to hear your reactions. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianereim.org. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. A special thanks to everyone at Politics and Prose and our engineers, Andy Gunn, Josephine Neonai, and Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Bent Landsberg of Wonderly. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.